Station number 20153.
Dennis Smith, Real 2.
Outside of this wall of the courtyard was a narrow road coming in between two German minefields, and here I was expected to lay an ambush for any German tanks that might come along this country road. And so, armed with a bag full of 68 anti-tank grenades, I laid there for several hours waiting. But fortunately, no one came. And so we gathered from that there was going to be no German counterattack on our position. The rest of the day I spent with the signals group helping to for the odd jobs or so, but not doing nothing in a great way. I can't recall I did anything specific during the day after coming in with the anti-tank grenades. But during the evening, a party of us were then sent back to the beach to recover the dead bodies of our comrades. And we had a burial party burying them in a garden of a bungalow nearby. We also carried ashore the bodies of Canadians who were there and any naval men, so that we cleared the beach of all the bodies.
Were there German bodies as well?
There were no German bodies on the beach, no. They were in their gun positions on the shore, yeah. The following day, we then went off to inland to Douve la Deliverand, which was about 1 kilometre or 1.5 kilometres inland from Langroon, where there was a German radar station. This was out of action because of the aerials were all destroyed, but the Germans still held the position in bunkers underground. As it didn't seem necessary to attack them at that point, they were left until a later date. But we rested in Douve la Deliverand for that day. And at that time, I recall that we were then running out of our Benzedrine tablets, which we'd been issued with us to take one every 6 hours to keep us going for the course of 2 or 3 days.
What effect do you think they had?
Well, they certainly they did what they were supposed to do, to keep you going without sleep. But when we'd finished them, I think we all then crashed out and we just slept and slept. And then we were there at Douve la Deliverand until the Sunday, must have been the 11th, 12th, Tuesday was the 6th of June, anyway. On the Sunday we then had orders to move. And we thought we were coming home because we were told that our operation was a 4-day operation. And instead we were then taken across, marched across the River Orne, across Pegasus Bridge, to join with the airborne forces holding their zone over the bridge. And I remember we crossed the bridge to the cheers of the airborne forces, who were pleased to see some reinforcements. And we moved into a place called Salonelles, which was the extreme left of the bridgehead, for a time we were called General Eisenhower's left-hand man. And we held a position at Salinelles from the 11th, 12th of June until almost the end of August. I don't recall the dates. But at that time, the they were preparing to push out from the bridgehead. The main front had swung around to the south and was heading east, south of Caen. And then we moved south of Salinelles to near Troarn, a place called Sanneville. We moved into a village that, where there was a brickworks. And we were very close to the German lines there. We had to talk in whispers because we were only hedgerows apart from each other for another couple of weeks. And this was the start line for when the airborne forces pushed out and we pushed out with them. And so in early September, we started the push.
Did you do much fighting in that area?
Not much in the Salinelles and Sanneville area. It was only patrolling. We had a static position, but we patrolled partly to keep the Germans on their toes, but I think probably also to keep ourselves on their toes rather than become too static. And so we did patrols into the German lines. And I did one not exceptional thing there. I recall that on one occasion, the Germans had a good idea where all of our movements, and it was suspected that that they'd found a place where they'd got an observation platform or something. And any movement in our line was greeted with gunfire, mortar fire, and so on. And one day, an airborne artillery officer came up with the object of wiping out this observation thing if it could be found. And so I was asked to go with him. We went in the early hours of the morning before it broke light. We went through the German lines, the officer, artillery officer, myself, and a corporal with an extra gun. We went through, across no man's land, through the German front line, and got behind it. And after a short while, he observed this observation place in a bunch of trees. You could see it from the back, but it couldn't be seen from the front. And I recall he gave me instructions to call down gunfire from the airborne artillery. And the first two or three shots were a little wide of the mark, but and then he changed the range. And the next time they opened up and they were right on target. I recall the trees all being blasted down, and I said, well, now what do we do? And he said, well, we'll get out of here, like Halley said. And which we did, and we made our way back out of their lines, across no man's land, into our own lines. And it was just an episode, really, in the took place during the static fighting, which was not very exciting, but such things as that made it more exciting. Yeah.
Can I just take you back to D-Day itself?
Yes.
Can you describe again the channel crossing that you had and
the channel,
the difficult landing?
The crossing itself was very rough. I think most people know that it was cancelled for 24 hours because of the state of the channel. It was very rough. We we went across all the way with our landing craft, small LCIs, and most of the men on board, although they were all experienced sailors, they were sick. It was that bad. However, when we arrived, I think most people, when we arrived over there, were glad to get off the boats, despite what they'd got to face the other side. We, as we approached, all was quiet for a while. It didn't seem as though there was any danger, but as we got very close in, and then all hell broke loose, we were under fire. Not only from ahead, but also to our left, because we were the extreme left of the Juno beach, and for 5 miles to our left there was no landings taking place, so we were getting fire from the flank as well as from the front. And because the tides were running high, the underwater obstacles, which they were still underwater, in fact, whereas if the tides weren't running so high at the time we landed, those obstacles should have been clear of the water. But due to the state of the tide, they weren't. And one or two of the boats were hulled and stuck on these obstacles way out. And our landing ramps on the LCIs, they were... you had two ramps, which were narrow ramps, and they weren't a fixture. They were rolled out by the crew and dropped down, but the inshore ends, because the tide was high, were floating, and they were unstable to land from, and a number of men were pitched over into 3, 4, 5 feet of water trying to land. We lost quite a lot of men being drowned, or if they were slightly wounded and they had no chance of getting ashore, they were drowned. And so in fact, the landing was a disaster, because we didn't get hardly 50% of the men ashore. And so it was difficult to reach our objective for that first day, which was the capture of Langerhoun Strongpoint. This was achieved during the next day.
And you said when you were with that chap called Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
did he tell you that his German name was Wies?
No, I knew that his name was Wies, yes.
How would you know that?
That I don't know. No, I'll be quite honest, I don't know. But... or did I find? I may have found out at a later date. He was eventually killed in our Walcheren landing.
Now, I think you were just about to tell me about the breakout from Normandy, please.
Yes, we broke out from Sanneville, our starting point, and we did it through a series of leapfrogging moves. The airborne attack during the day, we then went through overnight, infiltrated overnight to the next position, which would be controlling a vital point, a hilltop or so and so, and then during the next day the airborne would come through again to clear that area, and then we would go through again, infiltrate again at night. And we did this over the course of 5 days, and we advanced the front then. It was written that we'd advance the front 75 kilometres over 5 days. But by that point, we'd reached St. McClure, and it was decided at that point, I think, that that was where we then stopped, and we had a break. And it was, in fact, the first break that we'd had out of gunshot, away from gunshot, for 84 days, it was written. And that was a place called St. McClure.
Were there any grumbles amongst the commandos about being in action so long when you thought you'd be just a short time?
No, there didn't appear to be. But then we did have some grumbles from that point on. At St. Maclou, the airborne forces and number one commando brigade, the army commandos who had linked up on D-Day with the airborne, that was their part of the D-Day landings, they were returned home where we we were kept there. And that, then there were some grumbles. We had several days resting at St. Maclou. No more than a week, I wouldn't think. I sent the Royal Marine Band out there to cheer us up, I recall. And we then moved from there to cross the Seine. And we crossed the Seine at a village called Duclair. There were no bridges, they were all gone. And so some Royal Engineer bridge builders came up with their pontoons and floats and so on. And they ferried us across the Seine with their pontoons. Royal Engineers did this.
Was there any enemy opposition?
No, not at that point. Whilst we rested at St. Maclou, the enemy had gone on, retreated further. We then moved on to a place called Valmont, where we stayed a few days. And then we were backtracked to Le Havre. Le Havre had been captured. And we were moved into Le Havre, we gathered, to police it because there was a lot of unease in Le Havre, mainly because it had been terribly bombed. Very few Germans killed, but thousands of French people killed. And through the bombing. And the French people didn't take to us very kindly. And we spent a few days policing and trying to get some law and order into Le Havre.
What did the law and order problem seem to be?
Well, I think mostly the French people were so upset about the whole thing, the bombing and that, and I think they were tending to loot and so on, and the police had got no control, and I think the French people probably resented any sort of authority, and so we were sent in there to stamp some kind of authority on the place.
Did you have any personal incidents yourself?
No.
Did you have to arrest anybody?
No. Whether the others did, I don't know. I wasn't involved in that. No. The only good that I found that we had in Le Havre was the fact that we took over quite a few stores that the Germans had there with a lot of tobacco and drink and so on. So it was the first time that we were able to indulge, as you might say. And then we moved on from Le Havre, just inside of the coastline, and we made our way back up through, up to, and at this point, because they decided that we were staying over there and not coming home, and we were acting in a way as infantry, we were provided with some transport. So instead of having to footslog all the way, we were then provided with transport to transport us. And so we moved up as a part of the Canadian Army along the inside of the north shoreline of France, and we moved up to Dunkirk, and we took over from an infantry battalion surrounding Dunkirk. So Germans had retreated beyond Dunkirk, but they were holding Dunkirk. They also held Calais and held Dunkirk to deprive us of the ports. And we spent some time patrolling around Dunkirk. One or two little firefights, sending patrols in, and so on. And by this time, the main advance of the army had pushed on right across France, in through Belgium, whilst we were still at Dunkirk. And then we were called then up to Dihane, near Ostend. And we found then that we were then going to be used to do the Walcheren landing in Holland. And we trained on the German positions on the beaches at Dihane and around Ostend. We learned how to get into them and so on. And we spent, I don't recall how long there, doesn't seem too long, till eventually the 1st of November came and it was due to go. The landing was at Walcheren. And so we boarded the boats at Ostend on the night of the 31st of October. For the first time, we were to go ashore in Buffaloes, or as the Americans called them, Amtraks. And I don't recall doing any landing from Amtraks. The first sight of them we had was actually on the tank landing craft when we went aboard on the 31st. And we set sail, if I recall, somewhere midnight or just after midnight on the 31st on our way to Walcheren. On this occasion, I was carrying a radio, a new type of radio, which was supposed to be a great improvement on the others, number 46 set, inasmuch as it was an improvement because with an ordinary set, you had to, with all of them working on the same frequency, before you set off, you'd net them all to get them all on net, so that you were all spot on the same frequency. But with the 46 set, it was the first one that they'd brought out with a crystal, which was a given frequency. And it had two crystals, A and B, and so it's just a matter of switching from one crystal to another if you lost contact. It was supposed to be a good set, which it proved otherwise when I got ashore. So we set off and we landed about just before 10 in the morning. Terrible landing, under fire all the way. And apparently I didn't know at the time, though, that we were sailing through minefields because there was no chance of clearing the minefields. And I got ashore successfully. Buffalo came off. We had one hit on the boat going in, the buffalo behind us took one shell right in the driver's compartment, so that the crew were killed in the front of it. But we were okay, we got off all right. Once we got ashore, we made our way towards our first objective, which was a radar station. That caused no problems. The lads went through that fairly quickly. And then we came to the big stumbling block. It was the code name W-13, the big four-gun coastal battery. We made one attempt to attack it, and the lads in that troop were driven off with heavy casualties. And then this was where my radio set let us all down. I was asked to call in for more support and gunfire. Just couldn't raise anyone on it. And everybody was getting agitated. And so was I, because I was getting some flack from our men. But it was hopeless. And so I was working back to what we called, my job was working rear link. So I was working back to a set which was with our brigade coming in after us on the beach. We didn't know whether they had come in or not, or whether their set was gone. And I then thought, well, I'll try to get better contact by climbing up to the top of a sand dune and getting the aerial over the top. And so I then climbed up to the top of the sand dunes there, with places 25, 30 feet high. And I climbed up to the top of the sand dune, put the aerial over the top, just kept below the top myself. And very quickly, machine gun bullets went round the top of the aerial. So I was safe, I was all right, just below the top. But then came over a cluster of mortar bombs. And then I took shrapnel in the arm and the leg. And so through frustration, not being able to get through, I got hit. And that ruled me out from then on.
How serious were the wounds?
Not too bad. I was walking. I went to the dressing station. When I arrived there, the mortars had also killed their medical officer. He was dead when I got there. Anyway, I was dressed, and medical corporal ordered me to go back to the beachhead, which I refused, because that's the worst place you can go when there's a landing taking place, is to the beachhead.
Why is that?
Well, because that's where all the concentrated fire is, trying to stop reinforcements and so on. You see, beachhead's a terrible place in the first day or so of a landing, and I wouldn't go. And so I stayed up with another signalman, and just stayed with him, and got through the first day all right. And the second day, they scraped a hole in the sand for me at night to rest in, because I had my arm, I couldn't do anything with it. And spent the next night with them. And then 47 Commando passed through 48 and carried on the attack, and linked up so that there was an outlet from Flushing back to the mainland at Breskins. And that was the way I chose to go, and I made my way to Flushing.